On Tuesday, September 21st at 2 a.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature NEA Jazz Master and African Rhythms Practitioner Randy Weston. That's Tuesday, September 21st at 2 a.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And you are listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for Sugar in My Bowl. And I'm going to have to forego the theme because this program's action-packed. And my guest is going to be Randy Weston, co-hosted by Hank Williams, and a question by our videographer, Kazembe Balagoon. Stay tuned.
This is Hank Williams, and I'm here with Joyce Jones, and we have a wonderful guest today, which is NEA Jazz Master, practitioner of African rhythms, and now doctor, as he has an honorary doctorate from Brooklyn College, Brooklyn's own Randy Weston. And we also need to add another title to his already impressive credentials, which is that of composer, since his new autobiography, also titled African Rhythms, is just about to be released by Duke University Press. Randy, welcome. How are you doing?
Fine, Hank. How about yourself?
I'm doing wonderful.
Thank you, Randy Weston, for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Thank you. Glad
to have you.
Pleasure to be in the Sugar Bowl.
So, Randy, would you like to talk a little bit about the composition process with the book with Willard Jenkins, who also has credit as co-author or, in this case, arranger? Perhaps you could talk a little bit about what the process was like getting down your story and collaborating with him, and actually possibly if the process of writing is different from your compositional process in music.
Well, you know, what I did was I really talked in the microphone, you know. Which is the same thing I did with Melville Liston when we worked together, you know. And I just went back as far as I could go back, you know, time I can remember. And I talked about growing up in Brooklyn, in the Bedford Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, and my father, my mother, the neighborhood. And from that point on up until today.
The title of the book is African Rhythms, and that's also what you call your current group. I know you talk in the book about it and have talked about it extensively in interviews, but maybe you could go through that briefly for our listeners in terms of your approach to the music and how you see that coming together.
Well, I think it came about was in the late 50s. I was at Max Roach's house, you know, with Max Roach and Charlie Parker and Miles Davis and George Russell. And we were discussing the word jazz, and they said we never use the word jazz. We always say, let's play Ellington's music or Lena Horne's music or Count Basie. We never use the word, but it's called jazz, you know. And so listening to that conversation, I was thinking in my mind, what would I call my music, you know. And for me, the most natural way to describe my music would be African rhythms. And the reason for that is, I guess, my Panamanian Jamaican father, my Virginia mother, growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and being with all the cultures of African people from the continent, from the Caribbean. And for me, whether it was Southern fried chicken or whether it was some cooking from the island, it was a great similarity. And as my dad said, we are an African people. We never left Africa spiritually, no matter where we are on the planet. So I decided to call my music African Rhythms, because in my music is a combination of all the various names of what we call music, blues, jazz, calypso, all the different names, you see, but it's Mother Africa's contribution to music.
We see that in a lot of your compositions.
Tell us about arranger, trombonist, Melba Liston.
Well, you know, I used to play with a trio at Birdland opposite big bands like Count Basie and Dizzy Gillespie brought his band in, you know. This was like, early 50s, late 40s, maybe, something like that, you know. And in the band, he had Charlie Persip, he had Lee Morgan, he had all these giants, you know. And he did an arrangement. Melba Liston was a trombonist, and she wrote an arrangement of My Reverie. And this arrangement was so beautiful, you know.
Thank you.
So when she came off the bandstand, I just said, I just got to meet you. You know, she was a beautiful lady, great big sound, that trombone, and the arrangement was beautiful. And that's how we met. And at that time, I don't think she was living in New York, but she eventually moved to Harlem. And I met her a couple of times, and finally I had an opportunity to do a recording for United Artists. And I did 7 waltzes for children. And I wanted her to do the arrangements. And that's how it started. And I went to a little place up in Harlem, and I explained all the songs. One song is for a little boy, one for a little girl, my son, my daughter. One song for children ice skating. Another song for children climbing a hill. Another song for children singing the blues. Another song called Earth Birth, when a child arrives on the planet. It's music, you know. So Melba took it from there. And we got together Johnny Griffin, Ray Copeland, Idris Suleiman, Jamil Nasser on bass, and Charlie Persip on drums. And that was our first collaboration. And I was extremely happy. And the recording got something like 5 stars, because Melba, she was an original arranger in the sense she could take a small group and make it sound like a big band. And she was completely original.
Yeah, I'm actually learning more and more. The more I read about you, the more I learn about Melba Liston.
Oh, yeah. That was the beginning. And we worked together till the time she died. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did she feel about playing trombone? How was she as a musician?
She was a great trombonist. She had a huge sound. I never saw a woman playing trombone in the first place. First of all, I saw a woman playing trombone. She had this big, fat sound. But Melba was very shy. She was a very shy person. And when we did the first recording of the waltzes for children, I wanted her to play on the first piece, which is called Earth Birth, you know. And I had to fight with her to make her play on that piece, because every piece featured a different musician. I finally got her to play on it, but she loved to write. Arranging and composing was her real love, but for me, she was a great trombonist.
Well, since we started talking about Melba Liston, why don't we talk a little bit more about the Uhuru Africa recording?
Well, Melba and I, we were very close in many things. We had great pride in our people. We didn't like the image of our people, you know, and we were very sensitive of that. And I wanted to create a work of music to show us and to show the world that we're a global people. And we're in many parts of the planet, and we speak many different languages, but we all come from the same foundation, Mother Africa, our ancestral home. And that's where we get our spiritual energy from. So I put together a four-part suite. The first movement was called Freedom Now. And I went to the great Langston Hughes, who I got to know. I said, Langston, would you kindly write a freedom poem for me for Uhuru Africa? He said, of course. I wrote another song called African Lady. It's very important for us to recognize our mothers, our sisters, our daughters, those women that don't get the recognition they should. So I wrote a song called African Lady. And asked Langston, would he do a text for that? He said, of course he would. So that was kind of like the beginning. So the first move was Freedom Now. Second move was African Lady. The third move was Bantu. Bantu means Africa and the South coming together. And the last movement was called Kucheza Blues. And that blues is symbolic the day when African people get their freedom all over the planet. We're going to have a big party called Kucheza Blues. Now, going back a little bit, as a boy growing up, I was always upset about the image of our people, you know, the Tarzan movies, all the stereotype you see in cinema as a kid. But what made an impact upon me, the impression was we had no language when language was created in Africa. So I wanted to put Langston's poem into an African language. And I spent time in the United Nations talking to various diplomats at that time. And like this is the late 50s. And they all suggested that Kiswahili would be a good language to represent Africa. So I approached a man from Tanzania. His name was Tuti Mekisanga. He was a teacher of Swahili, and he was a delegate at the United Nations, you know. And he agreed to not only translate Langston's poem into Kiswahili, but he would also narrate on the recording because he had a great voice, you know. So that was the narration and the arranging side of the music. And now the musicians, it was an incredible orchestra. The reed section was Bud Johnson on tenor saxophone, Gigi Grice alto saxophone. We had Cecil Payne on baritone. We had Jerome Richardson on flute and also on saxophone. We had Les Spann also on flute and guitar. And we had Sahib Shahab also playing alto saxophone. And then we had Kenny Morrell on guitar. We had Max Roach playing marimba. Charlie Pasipa on drums. We had Candido and Amanda Peraza from Cuba. We had Babatunde Olatunji on African percussion. We had Ron Carter on bass and George Vivier on bass. That was a powerful rhythm section, right? The trombone section was Slide Hampton, was Quentin Jackson, and Jimmy Cleveland. We had Julius Irvin playing French horn. The trumpet section was Freddie Hubbard, Richard Williams, and Clark Terry. Okay. We had two great singers, Martha Flowers, she sang African Lady, and Brock Peters also sang African Lady.
How did you get Brock Peters, by the way?
Well, how did I get all of these people?
Exactly.
It was in the air somehow. And Candido had to go somewhere. I forgot where it was. So we had to schedule the recording 9:30 in the morning, 2 days in a row. Nobody was late. It was a spiritual undertaking. And Melba not only wrote the arrangements, she had musicians in my house all night long writing parts on the ceiling, on the walls. We had to carry the copyist on a chair. His ankles were swollen. We had to carry him down the stairs and carry him to the studio, still writing parts.
Wow.
Because Melba was very creative. She would do an arrangement, and last minute she would change something, you know. And she also conducted. So for me, it was a very incredible moment. I mean, her arrangements were original, flawless, daring, and to see this African woman not only write the arrangements, but also conducted the orchestra. So that was Uhuru Africa, and it was we recorded that in November 1960. And what's ironic about that, which I didn't realize until this year, in 1960, 17 African countries got their independence. So this year, 2010, the celebration of Uhuru Africa, our collaboration with Melville Dixon, Langston Hughes, and myself, and also 17 countries of Africa. So it was a powerful experience and a spiritual experience. Yes.
And you're going to be celebrating. You're going to have a big celebration in November at the Tribeca.
Exactly.
92nd yes. Street.
November 13th, we're going to put together. There aren't too many originals left. I think Charlie's Pacific is still playing with us in Candido. Clark Terry is still with us, but I think he's in Arkansas. All the others are ancestors, but we're going to celebrate, you know. Yes.
Uhuru! Freedom! Freedom first. Africa, where the great Congo flows.
Africa!
Where the whole jungle knows a new dawning breaks.
Africa!
A young nation awakes.
Africa!
Uhuru!
Africa!
Uhuru!
Africa!
Africa, ambako jua la angaza sana. Africa, ambako ulimwengu wote kwanza. Africa, kutoka usiku wa jana. Uhuru, upepo wa uhuru. Upepo wa uhuru unavuma. The freedom wind blows. Out of yesterday's night, uhuru.
Freedom!
Uhuru!
Freedom!
Uhuru!
Listening to WBAI in New York 99.5 FM. I've pretty much let Randy Weston introduce things for you, let you know what you're listening to. But let's see, I'll go back. Let's see, right now we're listening to the first movement, Uhuru Kwanzaa, by Randy Weston from Uhuru Africa. This was released in 1960, Roulette Records. I got this from a 2003 Mosaic Select number 4 compilation, which I actually got from WBAI during a fund drive. So that was a good premium. And and thank you to those who did support during the last fund drive. There's another one coming up in October, as a matter of fact. And yeah, I'll be having an Abby Lincoln special during that time. But let's move forward. Before that, we heard the introduction, Uhuru Kwanzaa, from Uhuru Africa as well. The third movement, Bantu, from Uhuru Africa. And let's see, before that, we heard Earth Birth by Randy Weston from Little Niles. It was originally released in 1965 on the Toshiba EMI label. This, too, was from the Mosaic Select No. 4, 2003 compilation. Melbalist and on trombone and arranger, Idris Suleiman, and Ray Copeland on trumpets, Randy Weston on piano, of course, Johnny Griffin on tenor sax, Jamil Nassar on bass, and Charlie Persip on drums. And we started, the first song we heard was Melba Liston's arrangement on My Reverie. That was the Dizzy Gillespie Orchestra from Burke's Works, Verve Big Band Sessions, originally recorded in 1957. This was from a 1995 Verve compilation. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and Randy Weston and Hank Williams. And on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
You also talk in the book about the struggle to actually get the album released after you already have the concept for it. And this also comes, it seems to me, it comes a little bit really before the curve, before people start getting a little bit more into Africa and developing that sort of consciousness. How difficult was it for you to actually do that?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, in life, there's certain people that come at certain times in your life, you know. And they make a contribution. And it was a man called C.B. Atkins. C.B. Atkins was a husband of Sarah Vaughan. And somehow I met C.B. and I told him what I wanted to do. And he talked to the head of Roulette Records. And that's how we did it. But they didn't know what we were going to do until we did it, you know. So it was quite controversial because, you know, the whole idea was for us to forget Africa. And the image of Africa was put in such a negative way. In Hollywood and the newspapers and the journals. But it was something meant to be. And it was mm-hmm. incredible because everybody was on time. And we had African people from all over the planet all come together. We only had about two or three rehearsals, but we had the same foundation. Because you see, music itself was created in Africa and music came out of Africa. And everything we do is based upon that foundation of African spirituality. And it was there during that recording.
You mentioned your relationship with Langston Hughes. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? How did you meet and wind up doing things together?
I was very fortunate. It was a very bad period after the Second World War. I was in the Army 3 years. You know, I came back, and a lot of the guys came back. And that's when they decided to spread the heroin and alcohol amongst our people. And it was always given to the artists, because the artists are the ones who influence people, you know. It was terrible, and I lost a lot of close friends, it was a disaster for the black community. So, but the Creator arranged for me through a wonderful semi-pro basketball player named Lefty Morris. He said, Randy, you get out of New York, you go up to the Berkshires. Now, at that time, I was running my father's restaurant in Brooklyn, and we had a restaurant that was open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. We had the hippest jukebox in the world. Had the latest of Monk or Sarah Vaughan or Ella or Basie or Duke. At the same time, we had modern music of Europe. We had Stravinsky, Shostakovich, Prokofiev. Musicians would come all the time to the restaurant, whether it was a Charlie Parker or Max Roach or Monk, always talking about music. So anyhow, I left New York and I went to the Berkshires. I went up there doing all kinds of work just to get out of New York. And that area is where the Boston Symphony Orchestra performs 7 weeks of the year. And students come from all over, in Lenox, Mass. They come all over the world to study opera, all European music, but the best people. At the same time, it was a place called Music Inn. And I went there with two young ladies who I was working with at a particular resort called the Seven Hills. And they said to me, Randy, here there's a place where there's some jazz. Maybe you'd like to come. And I went to this place called the Music Inn. I arrived at the right moment. And here was Professor Marshall Stern, English teacher from Hunter University, but he was also one of our first, shall we say, jazz scholars. And when I went to this resort, he had about 200 people, and he was playing some music, and he played Fletcher Henderson's King's Porter Stomp, and he played Benny Goodman's King's Porter Stomp. And he asked the audience, could they hear the difference? And then I got to know Marshall, and I realized he was the only critic I knew that started off the history of jazz with West Africa. And so he brought to this place called the Music Inn. That's where I met Langston Hughes. That's where I met Babatunde Olatunji. That's where I met Jeffrey Hola from Trinidad. That's where I met Candida from Cuba. That's where I met Mahalia Jackson. That's where I met Butterfly McQueen. He had this global concept of African culture. I met Brownie McGee, Sonny Terry. So that's where I met Langston. And then I got to be very close to Langston. We just had a natural rapport. And his two secretaries had an apartment on 13th Street in Manhattan. And they wanted to get back to Harlem. They gave me the apartment. And with Marshall Stearns, I started doing the history of jazz in the schools. This is like 1958, early 60s. And we were starting with Africa as the beginning of the music. And then we would end with Africa. And I put together a group, and we do music from Africa. We do the Caribbean. We do the Black Church. And the last piece was always the African Cookbook, which I wrote, which meant that Africa is the past, the present, and the future. Thank you. And Langston, we did a couple of things together like that. And he wrote the first book for children on jazz, Langston. He was brilliant. Not only a great poet and a great writer, but he also was very close to the music. And I didn't realize how close we was until we went to Nigeria together in 1961. And there were 29 of us went for a group called the American Society of African Culture. With that group was Nina Simone, Lyra Hampton, Langston Hughes, Jeffrey Holder, Brock Peters, Al Mims and Leon James, two dancers from the Savoy Ballroom, Martha Flowers, a great singer, Hale Woodruff. It was an incredible group, and that's when I got to realize how popular Langston Hughes was in Nigeria. And we spent 10 wonderful days together. And what happened, unfortunately, when he passed, only Langston could do this. It was in his will that he wanted me to play his funeral with the trio. And also in the will to make sure the musicians got union scale. So that was my spiritual mentor amongst others, Langston Hughes. Yeah.
in talking about Uhuru Africa, African Lady, was recorded by Abby Lincoln. She did record it on Straight Ahead.
She sure did.
Yeah. Do you want to tell me about your relationship with Abby Lincoln? Or?
Well, I met Abby because of Max Roach. For us, Max Roach, he was the emperor of Brooklyn. Mm. He was the guy. Mm-hmm. Because at his apartment, I met Charlie Parker. At his apartment, I met Dizzy Gillespie. At his apartment, I met Leo Parker, Miles Davis, George Russell, at Max's place. So when him and Abby came together, that's when I met Abby Lincoln. And she was like Max. She's a great artist, but very conscious of our people, very dedicated to our people, and very dedicated to the ancestors, you know. And when she did that recording, she did African Lady. I was very happy about, and she also did it with Max, you know. So that was a wonderful relationship. Growing up with giants like that, you know, very inspiring, yes.
Well, in the book, I believe in the chapter on Uhuru Africa, you actually choose an epigraph from Dr. John Henrik Clark, and you also included him in the conference program for the 1961 Afro-American Musician Society. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your relationship, because we don't often hear about Dr. Clark in relation to the music.
Well, you know, it was a lot of discrimination against African-American musicians, you see. So we decided to form an organization. We called it the Afro-American Musician Society. This was in 1961. And we would have meetings up at the Marketplace Gallery on 135th Street in Harlem. We'd have meetings in my apartment. When I say we, I'm talking about Melba Liston, I'm talking about John Handy, Sadiq Hakim, Nadi Kamar, Louis Brown, myself, and Ray Bryant, the great pianist. And we decided to have a convention of African-American musicians. And we got to St. Philip's Church. We approached Reverend Weston, and he gave us three days. And we had a three-day conference. And that conference, we invited musicians from Maine all the way to Florida to try to form an organization. So we had two keynote speakers. One was A. Philip Randolph, who talked to us about labor rights. And we had John Henry Clark to teach us about our culture and who we were as a people. So from that moment up until he passed, John Henry Clark has played a major role in my life. He was a brilliant, brilliant man.
Now, ultimately, at least the story you tell is that, unfortunately, the society did not really take off. And why is that? Or what were a few of the forces that made it difficult for you to move that organization ahead?
Well, it was, you know, Africa. African-American didn't exist at that particular time, you know. Deliberately, to cut us off from the richest place on the planet, which is our ancestral home, Africa, you see. So it was controversial. It shouldn't have been, because in the early part of the 20th century, people like U.B. Blake and James Reed Sherup and Ellington, they all identified with the continent, you see. But later on, we got separated from what our ancestors laid down. Marcus Garvey, all these people recognized that we were an African people and taken away from our homeland. So it was kind of difficult, you know, but much easier than what our ancestors went through.
That's true.
Much easier.
Well, I guess as a possible follow-up to that, can you talk a little bit about the African Union and your recent trip to the continent over the summer? Because I know they had an unveiling of a very large and impressive monument.
Oh, what an experience. It took place in Dakar on the 4th of April. And my wife and I were there, and it was hard to explain. This statue is huge. It's probably maybe the biggest statue in the world. Bigger than the Statue of Liberty, bigger than Rio de Janeiro. Huge. And this statue is the African family. This African man, the African woman, and the child. And it was so colorful. People came from all over Africa. We were with a group of 100 African-Americans. And the president of Senegal, President Wade, arranged a plane to take us there, you know. Members of Jesse Jackson's group of PUSH and members of NACP, Ron Karenga, myself and my wife. And it was quite an experience. For me, it was spiritually powerful. And they said that this is the foundation of the day where we will have the United States of Africa. So it was quite an experience.
Well, I know one thing that Dr. Leonard Jeffries has pointed out and has said has been very symbolically powerful for him is that it's actually pointing to us, to the West, as opposed to the East.
Exactly. They said that we are the sixth African nation, those of us in South America and the Caribbean and United States. And all we have to do is claim what's ours. It's very simple. We have to claim anything that belongs to anybody else. Our music, our way of life, our dance, you know. We have to get that to our children because today they're cut off from their heritage. And we have a great heritage. And we've created so many giants. Every day I'm learning more and more about African people. Every day of my life I'm learning something new, you see.
To interrupt anything, dialogue, music, otherwise, but I have to let you know what's going down. So what we're listening to right now is Serenade in Blue, Randy Weston Trio plus Cecil Payne. However, Cecil Payne is not on this particular song. It's from the release With These Hands, 1956 Riverside label. Randy Weston on piano, Ahmed Abdul Malik on bass, and Wilbert Hogan on drums. Before that, we heard African Lady. Yay! Abby Lincoln. And oh gosh, I've been around Max too long. Max Schmid. Who's coming up next? African Lady is from Straight Ahead. Straight Ahead is it's on the Candid label, and it was released in 1961. We have Booker Little on trumpet, Julian Priester on trombone, Eric Dolphy is doing that whole bird sounding thing on the flute, Coleman Hawkins on tenor sax, Walter Benton on tenor sax, some places, Mal Waldron on piano, Art Davis on bass, Max Roach on drums, Roger Sanders, and Robert Whitley on congas. Not on this recording, though. Okay, then. I mean, not on that particular African Lady. Oh, my goodness. I have to come back later and let you know. I spent too much time telling you stuff. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Most of your career has been as a band leader. Actually, I was wondering, how has that been? How were you able to do during that time? How were you able to have a career as a band leader?
You know, I didn't decide to be a professional musician until I was 29 years old. And I was playing when I was 17, but I didn't have the confidence to be a musician. You know why? And because I grew up in the period of royalty, of piano. So when you grow up with people like Nat King Cole and Count Basie and Art Tatum and Earl Hines and Errol Garner, you know, you got to lay back, you know. Monk and all, Bud Powell, you see. So I didn't really have the confidence to be a pianist because, like I said, that was the golden period of piano. I used to go ahead with William Lyon Smith and U.B. Blake. I mean, awesome. All these giants, you see. So not until I was 29, after a lot of encouragement from people who heard me play, I decided I was going to be a professional musician, but it took some courage. And when I became a musician, first of all, I was an African child, an African man. And I saw what my mother and father went through. The piano teacher getting 50 cents a lesson, and our people couldn't get work because of the way they looked, you know. We weren't beautiful because we had that chocolate skin and that wonderful hair, you see. So I've always been proud of my people, proud of my ancestors. So my music had to take that direction. But it was something that happened spiritually. And I had to project our music, the black church, the calypso, the blues, the jazz. Because what was so wonderful, our parents, they were the ones who took us to hear Duke Ellington, Andy Kirk, and they were the ones who bought the best music in the house. Because when we grew up, there was no such thing as separation. The music was for the young and for the old, you see. So we were lucky to have that spiritual foundation from our communities. So then my music only took that direction. But it was the direction that it was our heritage. I mean, you know, Louis Armstrong, all our giants, they performed for the black community. They played for benefits for handicapped children, hospitals, you see. We were part of the community. And so I had that foundation. And listening to people like Paul Robeson and learning what it is to be an artist, learning what it is to be a musician, going to 52nd Street and watching Coleman Hawkins and watching Buck Clayton and watching Cozy Cole, you know, and just really watching this rich culture. So my direction had to be to honor the ancestors and the respect and the love they gave us, because all of them never hesitated to help us, you know. If I want to ask Duke Ellington something, he would tell me. If I want to ask Dizzy something, he would tell me, you know. So it was that wonderful giving that the giants before us were like.
You had very rare sideman gigs. There was one in particular with Roy Brooks, a percussionist, drummer, and saw player. From in 1989, a duet in Detroit.
Do you have that?
I'm going to have it by the time this airs.
I don't have it. Would you get that for me?
Yes.
That's hard to describe.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to introduce just a fantastic, excellent percussionist, also a very dear friend, who I haven't seen in a long time. I'm very happy to introduce Mr. Roy Brooks. Roy and I have always had very similar tastes. We've always had tremendous interest in African culture in a very deep way, in a very spiritual way. And I'm so happy to be with him tonight.
Okay, let me do this quickly, very quickly. Okay, we're listening to Roy Brooks right now. That was an introduction by Randy Weston. What we're listening to right now is Waltz for Sweet Cakes, which was written by Randy Weston. It was actually the release of Duet in Detroit was released on in 1984 on NU Records. Roy Brooks on drums, percussion, musical saw, and Randy Weston on piano. And let's see, before that we heard Serenade in Blues, Randy Weston Trio, without Cecil Payne, plus Cecil Payne, but without him on that recording, With These Hands, 1956 Riverside.